Workers driven to desperate measures after not being paid for 7 months. The hotels they've been building will welcome fans from across the globe for the World Cup.
Recruitment agencies in Sri Lanka making female migrant workers take contraceptives. Some migration experts say contraceptives also serve the purpose of covering up potential sexual assaults.
Like many other domestic workers, Jessica's employer illegally confiscated her passport upon arrival and didn't pay her for a year and a half.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Millions of Sri Lankans have migrated to the Gulf region looking for work, but almost 1 in 10 of them then make a formal complaint to the consulate about abuse they've suffered or employer malpractice. There must be a better way to protect these migrant workers. Nilesh Fernando of Notre Dame, I think you'd call it Notre Dame, Nilesh, is one of a team that has reported on the success of policy to do exactly that. He joins me now. Nilesh, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here, Tim.
Why are so many migrants going from Sri Lanka to the Gulf? How important is migrant work for the Sri Lankan economy?
So just to start with, I'm very happy to be here, but I should also acknowledge that this work was jointly done with my co-author Naharika Singh, and also in partnership with a think tank based in Sri Lanka called Verite Research. But to your question, I think migrant work is incredibly important in this context for the simple reason that domestic labor opportunities are both lacking. Mm-hmm. And when you do have them, they're just not nearly as remunerative as the jobs you could have abroad. So a lot of research that's been done by folks like David McKenzie and Michael Clemens just tells you there are really large gains to be had from essentially doing very similar work in a different country.
But extraordinary numbers are traveling, aren't they? What work are they going to do?
You're right. Sri Lanka is a country of about 21, 22 million. And we estimate that the stock of migrants in the Gulf alone is somewhere close to about 2 million.
Wow.
So this is an incredibly large percentage of the labor force in Sri Lanka. The estimates are somewhere about 15 to 20% of the labor force, about 8.5% of GDP is accounted for by remittances sent by these migrants. And the type of work they're typically doing is, for men, it's typically construction work, as well as machinery operators, chauffeurs. For women, who make up about 50% of the migrants leaving Sri Lanka in any given year, the majority of those women are working in female domestic work, about 80%.
On one hand, looked at a face value, this is a wonderful economic story. People are able to travel to find work opportunities that they perhaps couldn't find at home. And because of that, then they can send money home and help their families. But of course, the abuse is the dark side of it. What kind of abuse is occurring?
I think it's no surprise if you, I don't know, read any kind of media outlet.
Well, yes.
Whether it's news media or TV media, with the Qatar World Cup coming up especially.
This is very timely, isn't it, with the Qatar World Cup, showcasing the enormous development that's happened in Qatar. Well, someone had to make those buildings.
100%. And I think it also brings an important spotlight to the issues faced by construction workers.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that's quite nice about the project that we did was that we observed complaints made by Sri Lankan migrants to consulates. And so we sort of observe this kind of universe of Sri Lankans abroad and the types of issues they face. If you look at the 120,000 complaints made over the course of a decade, the vast majority, maybe about 80% of those, are actually coming from female domestic workers, which are, of course, not mentioned in the context of Qatar. A lot of people are aware that there are issues of abuse faced by these migrants, which is the flip side to the high wages. The thing that's been difficult to do is to get systematic data on this because, you know, as you can see now as well, a lot of media access is being restricted around the World Cup and what you can actually go and film and who you can speak to. And so you have the problem that the folks who are letting you ask questions to these migrants are the folks who want you to ask questions from these migrants, not the subset of folks who don't want you to be there. With our data set, we're able to show that, yes, consistent with a lot of reports from, say, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, the abuse is very commonplace and widespread, and the incidence is, as you say, extremely high.
The idea that someone would go as far as making a complaint to the consulate, I mean, it shows that their experience here is not something that can be easily dismissed. When they make that complaint, though, what sort of power does a migrant worker have?
A very clear issue here is that we're probably missing out on a lot of the stuff that workers probably do want to complain about, because you know, it has to get to the level where it's so serious that you make a complaint to a consulate. And in spite of that, you know, this is 8% of all migrants over the course of a decade. Their recourse is very limited. You know, there's an absence of, say, civil society that can take up their claims or their grievances. They're not voters, so they're not a constituency for politicians in the Gulf countries, at least. So their power is very limited, except that they can make these complaints to the consulate. At an extreme, a consulate can repatriate them. Mm-hmm. But what might typically happen is a lot of the issues that migrants do face have to do with contractual disputes, wages being withheld. And so once you're back in Sri Lanka, you can petition the recruitment agency that sent you abroad to get those wages back through the regulator in Sri Lanka. And so that is something a lot of migrants do.
This project, your work, focuses on the role of intermediaries. We could call them migration agencies. If this process is working well, how do migration agencies help migrant workers?
Primarily in two ways. One is that for a lot of the folks who are migrating, this might be the first time you've even gotten a passport, which is, I think, a very difficult thing to do, getting visas, etc. Ideally, what the agency would do is develop some specialization in getting that, lowering those costs for would-be migrants. And the second part is you're paying somebody to send you to a job in a country you've never been to before, perhaps a language you don't speak, culture you've never experienced. So the critical thing there then is you really hope that they place you with an employer that honors the contract that you signed up for, pays you your wages. So it's that screening part, sending you to an employer who is going to honor the contract, not abuse you, which I think is the second really important thing these agencies do or should do.
Should do. And that's the point, isn't it? Given the number of complaints, it's clear that this is not working well. And many of these migrant agencies are not doing the job that we hope that they would do. So if they're failing in their duty of care, is it that they don't know enough about the employers, or is it that they know about the employers, they just don't act on what they know?
I think it's a really important question. The answer to that question, I think, is likely a combination of those factors. On the one hand, it's certainly the case that, you know, if you're working in construction work relative to, say, sitting at a desk being an accountant, you are likely to face a lot more occupational hazards. So there's some part of it that is intrinsic to a job. There's some part of it that's intrinsic to, say, the labor laws in a country and how they do or do not get enforced. And that part, you can't really put that on the intermediary, on the recruitment agency. The part that you can, I think, which is what our work shows and what really what motivated our work, is that these agencies do seem to matter a lot in terms of the outcomes that migrants experience. Specifically, if you were to compare agencies that have been in this business for 10 years, send very similar types of migrants, domestic workers, to the same country, and you looked at maybe 1,000, 2,000 migrants that they have sent, what's the likelihood that they experience a problem? You see really large differences across these agencies. If you thought it was just completely chance, you wouldn't expect to see those differences.
This program is rating the migrant agencies, isn't it? I think it gives them a star rating. Who's actually doing this rating, and how does it get the rating, and which agencies does it rate?
In this industry, the migrants who are looking for work, there are the employers out in the Gulf countries, Qatar, Saudi, etc.
Yep.
There is the recruitment agencies, who are the intermediaries based in Sri Lanka, who recruit the migrants on behalf of these employers. And then there's the all-seeing, all-powerful regulator in Sri Lanka that oversees this entire process. That's called the Sri Lanka Bureau for Foreign Employment. That's the migration regulator, essentially. And so they decided to institute a program of rating these local recruitment agencies, as you suggest. So kind of like an Uber rating, find some way to quantify the quality of the services provided by these recruitment agencies and make it publicly available.
And is it trying to give that rating to every recruitment agency?
No, that's sort of the critical feature of this policy that lets us figure out the effect of this program. As with many policies, this regulator decided to do something arbitrary. They said that the recruitment agencies who were eligible for this program needed to have sent more than 100 migrants in the year 2009.
Okay.
And this was revealed retrospectively. So because of that, we can compare agencies that had sent just above 100 migrants to those who had sent just below, giving us a valid counterfactual. And that's the basis of the comparison. So then we're really comparing the agencies who, by a quirk of, it's not nature, of bureaucratic decision-making, were eligible for this program to those who were not.
When you look at those two groups, what outcomes for workers are you measuring here? And where do you find the data to be able to match the outcomes for workers with the ratings of the agencies that they are using?
This is in large part due to the bureaucratic nature of migration in Sri Lanka in this case, though it's not specific to Sri Lanka. I think across the world, it's often the case that if you want to get a job abroad, you have to apply for a visa, the stuff gets documented, you go to an airport, you fill in a bunch of forms, etc. As it turns out in Sri Lanka's case, and this is true for many Southeast Asian countries as well, all of this data is hoarded by these government agencies. And so we were able to work with this regulator to get access to this data, which, to put it very simply, records which migrant went to which country to work for which employer through which agency. So we can make that migrant to agency to employer match. But then in addition to that, countries who are concerned about their citizens being abroad typically have consulates, and these migrants are making complaints to those consulates. We were able to get access to those databases as well and match it to the migrant agency employer database. So the types of outcomes we're able to look at, a lot of it is at the agency level, so it aggregates migrant outcomes. But there are things like, what are the wages being paid to these migrants? What are the features of contracts? For example, are they being provided amenities by the employers at whom they're placed? And perhaps most importantly, what's the incidence of abuse and contractual issues they face once they get those jobs?
Now, here's the thing that might surprise a lot of people. You did your evaluation during the time when those ratings are being compiled, but it's 2 years at which they're not known yet. So there's no new public information here. What are you trying to measure here? What would be the difference?
The way the program was designed essentially consisted of two phases. The first phase was where agencies were essentially told, hey, there's this new program we've decided to create. You're either eligible for it or you're not by this arbitrary cutoff. And then in that same communique, there was a list of criteria told, these are the things we're going to grade you on. Mm-hmm. And by the way, 2 years later, you'll get this rating and that'll be revealed to the public. So there's a kind of lead up to the rating, and then there's sort of the post-rating period. So we call the first phase reputational incentives, because that's the point at which being told, here's the stuff you're going to be judged on, get your act together. And then there's the, here's your rating, everybody can see it, everybody can respond to it. The really important part, I think, about that first phase, the reputational incentives phase, is that at a theoretical level and an econometric level, it's made a lot simpler to understand what's going on, because the only person that has agency are the agencies, so to speak.
Right.
They're the only people who can respond to the program. Migrants don't know about the program and the employers don't know about the program. We can see the pure response to these reputational incentives that these agencies have.
Call that first phase the get your act together phase. Did they get their act together? Was there an impact on the behavior of agencies?
Yeah, surprisingly enough, there was. What we find is, on average, the agencies respond by placing migrants with less abusive employers. So typically what's going on here is that there's what's called a job order. A job order is essentially a contract sent by an employer. And we can observe in the data which employers you're sending migrants to, and then rate the quality of those employers using those complaints that were made against them before the program happened. Mm-hmm. So at this point, we know roughly who's a good employer, who's a bad employer, and whether the agencies who are eligible for the program systematically choose to send their migrants after the program is announced to good employers versus bad employers. We find evidence to suggest that. And the second thing we find evidence for is we can also get a sense for which agencies needed to get their act together the most before this program happened. There are some agencies that seem to be doing a good job. There are other agencies that seem to be particularly errant. We would expect the agencies that were really doing a poor job to be the most responsive to the program. And that is what we find.
So even during this get your act together phase, they're working to enhance their reputation. There are measurable benefits occurring for the migrant workers.
Exactly. And I think what we're able to show is that the way these agencies respond, and this is really going back to your earlier question of what information do these intermediaries have? Do they have private information? The thing that I think speaks to that point is we know which employers the agencies were working with before the program started, and we know whether those employers were good or bad. What we can then observe is that what these agencies do in response to this program during the reputational incentives phase is that they systematically choose the employers that were better, that were less abusive.
Mm-hmm.
So that suggests that they have some sense of the quality of these employers. And
yes, it does.
When they have reason to systematically place migrants with them, they do so.
Everything about this, there's a good news to it, but there's also bad news there, that there was information there before that wasn't being acted on. When these ratings come out and we know about the quality of the agencies, how does that affect the behavior of migrant workers? How does it affect the behavior of the agencies?
Great question. And I think the larger point from this exercise is governments typically do have a lot of this information, and I think could be very beneficial to migrants because, as I mentioned before, they have consulates, there are visas, international travel is a heavily regulated activity. So the information exists. That information isn't made publicly available for the most part, and it could be very beneficial to migrants. But the second part, in the specific case, the way the government made these star ratings available essentially excluded migrants, for the simple reason that these ratings were made available on the internet through a database, a searchable database.
Aha.
And so the main consumers of this information were really the employers. Migrants had some sense of what was going on here. Agencies, of course, knew what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, the migrants themselves, who you might imagine would have benefited the most from observing this information in the post-star revelation phase, they were excluded for the most part from being able to see this. So there are some great things about this program, the reputational incentives phase, which I would broadly characterize as if you tell agencies to get their act together and you're a regulator, they will.
Mm-hmm.
That's promising. But the way in which you implement this program in this case was also unfortunate because migrants didn't have access to these ratings.
But the employers do, so they have some new information about this. Does this change their behavior?
It does.
Ah.
And so what we were able to see here was that we're able to construct the exact formula that the regulator used to compute these ratings, essentially by hiring the bureaucrat who designed it to tell us how they did it. And it's a long story. But having done that, we knew the secret sauce and how to put it together. So what we could do, compare agencies using a regression discontinuity design, which is essentially to say that there were some agencies that got the same rating. They were like, one got 100, the other one got 99. One just happened to get 3 stars, the other one got 2 stars. But those agencies are, for the most part, the same. So then we can compute what's the effect of a marginal star on what these foreign employers do. And we see that there's a really large response to these ratings by employers abroad, rewarding those agencies who are, you know, deemed as being more reputable by the government.
This seems to be putting some more checks and balances into a system that really needs them. But we have known about the potential for abuse of migrant workers. We have known about the stories of real abuse of migrant workers for a very long time. Governments seem very reluctant to act on this on either side. Do we have to say we settle for this sort of policy as a best, second best? Could we be doing more?
It's a really important question, and it opens up a lot of issues. At some level, I think countries like Sri Lanka profit immensely from sending migrants abroad. The remittances given to the country through this system of migration is incredibly important. In fact, the Sri Lankan government banned a lot of migrants in the year 2014, specifically because of the types of abuse issues they were facing.
Mm-hmm.
And that completely destroyed their reserves of foreign currency. That wasn't the only thing. There were other policy mishaps, but this was one thing. It's this Faustian bargain where everybody knows that migrants are earning decent wages, but abuse is really commonplace. I've spoken to some government bureaucrats who ask me, is this a mass government-sanctioned human trafficking? That's an exaggeration, but it's not without some truth.
Yeah.
What our research shows is I don't think it's a reason to let governments pass the buck. I don't think it's a reason to say, you know, it's all Qatar's fault that these workers are experiencing these issues. Of course, there are issues in Qatar and in Saudi. That's a really important part of the story. But it's not a reason to say that governments themselves can't do anything about it. And what's exciting about this research is it says through domestic regulatory policy, through giving these agencies incentives to get their act together and informing migrants, governments can measurably improve outcomes for migrants.
The spotlight in the next couple of months is going to be on this system of migrant work, and it's going to put the spotlight on again and the human cost of development as well as the money that can be earned. So this work is a really valuable contribution. Thank you very much for talking about it, Nilesh.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to talk about it.
The paper is called Regulation by Reputation, Intermediaries, Labour Abuses and International Migration. And the authors are Nilesh Fernando, you've just heard from him, and Niharika Singh. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode, as always, is to subscribe. Go on, do it as soon as you finish listening to this. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review and a rating as well. 5 stars is best. You can always find our past episodes and articles about the papers we feature at voxdev.org.